Carolyn asked me to speak about something in particular this evening, so that's what I'll start with. And then what I'd like to do is I'd like to introduce you to a short text that you'll find online that you can print off and that you can, if you're interested, you can work with over the summer. It's five stanzas. It's called the Four Mindfulnesses, and it was something the Dalai Lama taught in Long Beach, and something that, interestingly, was in a book that I picked up in 1973, and I read and made totally no sense to me at all, and then completely forgot about for now, let's see, 1973 to... almost 40 years. Now there's a terrifying thing to say. Forgot about for almost 40 years, and then he taught it in Long Beach, and I thought, wow, that's profound. 40 years, jeez. It's amazing how stupid you can be if you put your mind to it or don't put your mind to it, whatever the case may be. Anyhow, I put the translation by Jeffrey Hopkins online, and I'll link it up the same time as I post this recording. So I could talk about it a little bit tonight and also in 2 weeks after our potluck starts. And if you find it interesting, if you think it'd be useful, you can work with it over the summer, was what my thought was. And then when we come back again in the fall, I would pick up with that. And we'll just see where that goes. So anyway, to start off and to address what Carolyn asked me to talk about, which was the three fundamental types of consciousness. And this is actually something that's woven into Vajrayana Buddhism very deeply, or Tibetan Buddhism. And on the one hand, it's something that's very simple, and on the other hand, it's something that's very subtle. So the three fundamental types of consciousness are something that we already know about, that we already have, which is the kind of waking, rational, analytic, objective kind of consciousness we have right now as we're sitting in this room, talking and listening. Then there's the kind of consciousness or awareness that we have when we're dreaming, and we all know about what that is too, sort of. But anyhow, we experience it every day, just like waking consciousness. And the third is dreamless sleep, which we think we know about because we experience it every night, but we sort of don't know about it, and we sort of know we don't know about it because we don't notice anything. I mean, we're either dreaming or we're awake, or we know that we weren't doing either, but we don't know what we were doing. I mean, I have this experience. You know, I wake up and it's kind of like, okay, I mean, I was absent for a while. The world went on without me. But as moderns, we don't tend to call that a state of consciousness. We call it a state of unconsciousness. So the thing is, what is it that Buddhists mean when they talk about three states of consciousness then? Because it sounds to us like there are only two. So what their view is, and this is actually traditional throughout Asia, it's not just Buddhists who have this point of view, but pretty much all the Hindu schools have this point of view, and maybe the Taoists have this point of view also, although I don't know. But between Hindus and Buddhists, that covers an awful lot of territory in itself. I'm not sure what Muslims think about it. I'd be curious to look it up sometime. The Buddhist view, as is the Hindu view, is that dreamless sleep is awareness of nothing. It's analogous to being in the Carlsbad Caverns, which is, when they turn the lights off, the darkest place you can imagine. You're not blind, but you cannot see anything. It is darker than you can imagine if you've never been in that kind of situation. We think we know what dark is, but that's dark. When they turn the lights off, there's no light at all. And it's a very interesting experience. But obviously you can see, so you're seeing nothing. So both the Hindu and the Buddhist view is that dreamless sleep is a state in which you're aware, but none of your senses function. So there's nothing to be aware of. But you are aware. So that's very different than the Western view, which is you're unconscious, you're unaware. And those are two different things. To be aware of nothing and to be unaware are actually two different things. So these are the three states of consciousness. And we experience them every day. Now the thing about this state of awareness of nothing is it's a state of unity, if you think about it. There's only one thing. There's no diversity. And for a lot of people, that's actually the goal of the spiritual path, to experience a state of complete unity in which there's no separation between themselves and anything else. I mean, some people call that the experience of God, or some other kind of, you know, very refined, wonderful experience. Because a lot of what it is that makes us unhappy or confused or what have you is what comes out of our being separate, disconnected, and that sort of thing. And here you're connected with everything, except that there's only one thing, which is you. But there's nothing that you're not connected with, because it's just all you. From my personal point of view is that's why sleep is so refreshing, actually, and why we need it so much, because it's like a vacation from all the disconnection and complexity that goes on, you know. And if we don't get that vacation from our presumed reality every day, we go nuts. I mean, I have times when I don't get to sleep at night at all, and boy, the next day is terrible. And I can see it on other people. Rory, who teaches anthropology, walked out of his office the other day. I was in doing some Xeroxing. I looked and I said, Rory, what? It's like, he said, I didn't sleep at all last night. I couldn't figure out why I was, but I didn't get any. It was just apparent. It was just apparent that there was something that had happened that was just disconcerting him and uncomfortable for him. So, anyway. So now here's then the interesting thing. That if this dreamless sleep really is this wonderful state that not only is refreshing, but fulfills what a lot of spiritual traditions describe as kind of a goal of spiritual practice, then what's the point of spiritual practice? I mean, all we have to do is fall asleep. It's like, and it's good, you know? I mean, no sitting in meditation with your back and knees hurting, you know? None of this dieting stuff, no chanting and getting hoarse, turning rosaries and getting, you know, a callus on your thumb and all this. Well, anyhow, you get the idea. So what would be what's the point then? You know, why sit zazen so that your mind will calm down? You just go to sleep. If you can, go to sleep. Well, the answer to that is that that's actually not the answer, because the answer is not a matter of mere unity. The answer is diversity and unity together. The multiplicity of what we experience in our waking state combined with an experience of that, combined with the experience of the unicity we experience in dreamless sleep, combined with what's going on when we're dreaming. So both the Hindu and the Buddhist prescription, if you will, in regards to this point of view, is that the problem is that even though all those three states of consciousness, and I don't say mind, right, consciousness, those three states of consciousness are something we experience in a cycle in every 24 hours, usually, even though that's something that's very normal, the three are mostly disconnected from each other. And so then spiritual practice becomes a matter of getting all three to happen in the same moment. Getting all three to happen in the same moment. So the rationality, the sense of the objective reality of the ordinary world, combined with the mutability imaginativeness and vibrancy of dream combined with the total unicity of deep sleep is a way of understanding what the goal of spiritual practice is. That you could describe that as realization or enlightenment or God consciousness or whatever you want. So that seems like that's just ridiculously simple. And, you know, I mean, I really do think that the truth of the matter for Buddhism, as for many religions, is the truth is ridiculously simple. It's just that our minds, now here I do mean minds, our analytic minds, are not comfortable with ridiculously simple. Our minds want complicated and esoteric and deep philosophy and everything else. But in all honesty, if you look at everything that's in Buddhism, all the complexity in Buddhism is about the path. The complexity is about explaining what it is you need to do to get to the goal. But the goal is insanely simple. It's so simple that if someone tells you this is what it is, your response is, nah. How can that be? I mean, that's just, you know, that's too simple. But Buddhism is about taking away. It's not really about adding. It looks like it's about adding because there's all this stuff you need to do. But all the stuff you need to do is about taking away. It's like, well, you've seen the garden around this house, okay? It's like it's a huge amount of work to go out there and start pruning stuff away. There's vast amount of work in getting rid of the luxuriousness, which is over-luxuriousness, to get down to the basics of what's really important. And if you don't prune the roses, you don't get flowers, you know? I mean, that's kind of the way it is. You get a big jumble of stuff and it's unpleasant. But you, well, you get some flowers, but you don't get many flowers, you know? So it's about taking away. So when someone tells you that, well, it's just like, you know, it's simple. It's just get rid of all this stuff that, right? No, that can't be. But the thing is, as in pruning the garden, you have to know what to take away and what not to take away. It's not that simple. I mean, obviously, for example, this is not a good time to go outside and start pruning the roses because they're just starting to blossom. You know, we prune them 3 weeks ago and we can prune them in 2 weeks, but this is not a good time to prune them. Right? So it's the same thing with taking away. You have to know what to take away and when to take it away. And so that's what all that complicated stuff is all about. So you need to know the way in which to bring these three types of consciousness together. It doesn't work to go down to the liquor store and get 2/5 of vodka and chug them and say, now I'm enlightened. I mean, that is a way to bring all these three states of consciousness together, sort of. I mean, there is a moment where you're kind of in this, you know, rational, dreaming, unitary state. I think it lasts about, you know, a few seconds, maybe between, you know, the 6th and the 7th shot or something. I don't know what it is. And then it's like, you're gone. Well, you know, I say that humorously, but there actually was a debate in Tibet between the Zen party and the gradual path party in 8.5, 8.10, 8.15, 8.20 AD. I don't even remember the details anymore, but there was a big debate about it. There was a debate about practice anyway. And one of the great scholars from India who was there said, look, you know, if all you had to do was stop thinking and then you'd be enlightened, then you might as well just go get drunk. So I'm not original when I say this. I mean, you know, Shantarakshita said this, and he was one of the greatest of Indian scholars. So that's not the solution, because of course we know when you get drunk, you wake up the next morning and you have a hangover and nothing's any better. Maybe things are even worse, as a matter of fact. So it's a matter of how do you bring these things together. Now, one of the things that the Vajrayana path of working with images does is it brings these things together. And this text that I'll be sharing with you actually pinpoints that. One of the things that it says is that you work with images to generate a certain state of mind, which is, the usual term is blissful, but you could describe it as peaceful or joyful or happy, and that peaceful state of mind focuses your attention. That actually the whole reason for working with images is to generate a stable and joyful state of mind so that you can take that mind, and here I do mean mind, not consciousness, I mean your analytic mind, and you can place it on elements of your experience, and you can look at them closely, and you can keep your mind seated, placed, stable on what you're looking at because you're not distracted. And one of the reasons you're not distracted is because your inner state of experience is so elevated and joyful that there's there's less tendency to be distracted, you know. Do you all remember Ram Dass from, you know, the 60s and 70s? Ram Dass used to say, you know, one of the things about making love is you really don't, when you're into it, you're really not too much interested in thinking about anything else. I mean, why would you? Of course, this was, you know, 60s and 70s, and everybody was 40 years younger, and their hormones were a lot more functional than they are these days. So that all made sense to everybody. It's like, yeah, well, of course, you know, I got that one. You know, you get older, and it's, gee, the taxes are due in a couple of, you know, it's like, there's other stuff on your mind where there shouldn't be, perhaps, but there is, and that's just the way it is. Yeah. Well, we're not into April anymore. So it's June now, isn't it? Yeah, it's June, so. It's what?
Still April for.
Yeah.
Always April.
For April.
Somehow I'm gonna have to edit that. Anyway, you know, it's just, I mean, that's one of the things that, I mean, commonly that people just worry about, so that's why I went for it. You know, or making the rent, how's that? Whatever. But the point is that this kind of inner state of mind, this joyfulness, this elevated lightness or bliss, as is usually translated, does focus the mind. And it's easy to just say, hey, that's great, I'm going to hang out there and leave it at that. But from the point of view of practice, which is to take away the unnecessary so you can get to what's essential, from the point of view of practice, that is part of the technique for taking away the unnecessary, because it focuses the mind, and then you can put that focused mind onto your experience, and then you can look at your experience closely and in a new way and see things that you don't ordinarily see when you're in your usual distracted state of everydayness. So I'm not going to go farther down that line, because that is what I'm going to pick up on with this text of the four mindfulnesses. The four mindfulnesses are mindfulness of the guru, mindfulness of altruistic intention, mindfulness of the body as divine, which has to do with this practice of seeing yourself as a Buddha, which is what we practice, and mindfulness of the view of emptiness, which is understanding the essential actual nature of things. And if you hold those four mindfulnesses, according to the 7th Dalai Lama, who wrote this, if you can hold those four mindfulnesses and practice within that context, then there's a lot of achievement, and there's a lot of development. I mean, I remember a teaching that His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave, which has really stuck with me, and is related to this, and this is where I'll close this particular approach. He said, if you can meditate on the emptiness of consciousness itself, then you can meditate on the emptiness of your own consciousness. And of course, we know emptiness has a very specific meaning. If you can meditate on the emptiness of your own consciousness, that's the greatest progress. And to do that is to not say that consciousness does not exist, but it's also not to say that it's exactly what we think it is. Because what I find, anyhow, for myself, over and over again, is I think I know the nature of my own awareness. I think I know it. But you know, when I look at it really closely, I discover I really don't. That my thoughts about what my own awareness is are what I know. And that's the very thing that prevents me from having a deeper and deeper and deeper understanding of my own actual nature. I see this all the time. So meditating on the emptiness of consciousness is meditating on the actual nature of consciousness, empty of my ideas of what it is. Again, it's a removing process, and it's that one in particular is not easy, but those are some of the things that we'll be looking at. The first of the four mindfulnesses is mindfulness of the guru. And some people in this room, some people have a lama, have a teacher. Lama is the Tibetan word for guru. Some people have a personal teacher. Some people do not. Some people perhaps don't want one. But the reason for remembering the lama is that the lama represents the enlightened mind, is a symbol or an icon of the enlightened mind that we're all striving for, or the realized mind, or the liberated mind, or the joyful mind, or the free, whatever we want to call it. Whatever it is we're looking for in spiritual practice, the lama is that. So, in the Tibetan tradition, which is what we mainly practice, as you know. I mean, Kaylai and I have both been involved in the Zen, but we mainly practice the Tibetan tradition now with probably Zen seasoning. In my case, a lot of Zen seasoning. In Kay's case, maybe not so spicy, I don't know. She'd have to answer that. Mine's like... My Austrian grandmother used to make puddings, noodle puddings, and the top was black. It was pepper. So that's the kind of spice that... that's my Zen spicing on my Tibetan casserole. It's thick. But in the Tibetan tradition, one person who's everybody's guru, that nobody has any trouble with the idea of his being their guru because everybody thinks he's so cool, is the Dalai Lama. So one way that you can practice, if you want to experiment with this, without getting into all kinds of weird relationships with people and so on and so forth, because you can't get into a weird relationship with him because it's so difficult to get a private meeting with him, is you can practice with a Dalai Lama. And an easy way to do that is to get a nice image and put it someplace. And when you do your meditation practice, sit with that image. And then you do the practice that we talked about where, you know, the lama begins in front of you. You can visualize him. Then he comes to your head and then he enters your body and you and he become one. That's the essence of guru yoga. It's that simple, really. It's that relationship of understanding that the lama represents the essence of what you are already, but in the beginning it looks like he's separate. And he's real safe to practice with, and in fact, you know, he's been trained to fill that role since he was a child. You remember the movie called Kundun? Okay, Kundun is Tibetan for the presence. That's what it means, presence. Because what he's about is he's the presence of the enlightened spirit among the Tibetan people. So you can practice with that. We're not Tibetans, but it's okay. He says it's okay. So that's one thing you can do. And if you want to get even a better feeling for him, you know, you order some DVDs so you can get a sense of who this person is, because that's another thing that's really nice. You can just pop a disc into your television and there's the Dalai Lama talking to you with all his humor and personality and everything else. And so you can get a personal relationship with him in that way. As a matter of fact, I just ordered a bunch of DVDs for that very purpose, because we had such a great experience being around him, as in two of 10,000 people. But anyway, being around him in Long Beach, it was such a great experience that I felt, how do I reinforce that when I need to reinforce that? You know, and a DVD is a good way to do that. So that's a place where you can begin the practice of guru yoga, if that's something you want to do. I mean, you don't have to, but it's in my experience, it's really a very powerful practice. It really is very extraordinary because, you know, I mean, the Buddha or Jesus Christ or whoever you want to imagine as the spiritual ideal, they're all very wonderful, but as the text says, you're not going to meet them. You're not going to meet Shakyamuni Buddha. That's not going to happen. You're not going to meet St. Francis. You're probably not going to meet the Dalai Lama either. But at least you can see him on DVD. And you can't see St. Francis on DVD or Shakyamuni or Jesus or Muhammad or any of those folks. So, and you know, we're human beings and we forge relationships with people that we're familiar with. We don't forge relationships with total abstractions. And if we try to forge a relationship with a total abstraction, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, you can read great literature and you can forge a relationship with the characters in great literature. And the author will present them to you in a certain way or in a play. You know, the actress, actor will present them to you in a certain way. But it's not necessarily, it's not a real person. You know, lamas are real people, but it's different. So that's, I think, where I'll leave it. And